Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Monday, March 30th, and this is our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, packed as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. And Maya, honestly, diving into this week's news feels a little like starting a chess game three moves behind. So much is interconnected, and the stakes are incredibly high.
Three moves behind is generous, Alex. We're going to unpack how to invest despite that complexity, starting with core principles and the market mechanisms that still surprisingly function.
Then we'll shift gears and ask, is AI actively changing the rules of modern conflict? It's not just about drones anymore.
And speaking of rules changing, did you know global trade volume is predicted to slow by 2.7% this year, with major power shifts underway? We'll break down the new landscape.
Right, and then a little closer to home, we're diving into the shadow banking system, specifically the rise of private credit and the liquidity risks building up.
Risks that could ripple very quickly. Finally, we'll finish with a deep dive into U.S. foreign policy and the increasingly sophisticated world of information warfare. Buckle up.
Honestly, Maya, you always find the most unsettling topics first thing on a Monday.
Someone has to, Alex. Let's get started. Cal Grieve mentioned Peloton's $400 million factory investment as a prime example of optimization gone wrong. Let's start there, investing principles in a world that's actively trying to trick you.
That's a potent starting point. Grieve's core argument, as I understand it, isn't about avoiding optimization, but about recognizing its limitations and the potential for catastrophic failure when environmental assumptions shift. It's a reminder that all models are wrong, some are just less wrong than others, and the danger lies in mistaking a model for reality. The factory investment perfectly illustrates that. It was optimized for a very specific, temporary environment, COVID lockdowns, and utterly failed when conditions normalized.
So let's find the most efficient path and more prepare for the path to change. Feels less comforting.
Stepping back, it's about understanding economic forces and human behavior, and the interplay between the two. Markets aren't rational actors, they're collections of individuals reacting to perception and narrative. That perception drives valuation and can even create monopolies, even if the underlying business isn't inherently dominant. Think about the power of brand narratives and how those can inflate prices beyond intrinsic value.
Which means, basically, that understanding what people think is happening is more important than what is happening. That sounds unscientific.
Not entirely. It's about integrating qualitative and quantitative data. Grieve stresses the importance of both. But human behavior introduces a layer of complexity that pure quantitative analysis can't capture. Consider scarcity, for example. It drives innovation and pricing power, but as Costco demonstrates, removing scarcity can also be a successful differentiator. It's not a simple equation.
Costco deliberately doesn't play the scarcity game. That's a decent counterpoint. But what about companies that actively manufacture scarcity? Hermes and the Birkin bag come to mind. Is that just brilliant marketing, or is there something deeper at play?
Hermes's pre-spent strategy, requiring customers to purchase other items before being eligible for a Birkin, is a sophisticated method of building scarcity and increasing revenue per customer. It's about making customers work for the desired product, creating a self-reinforcing brand prestige. It's not just limiting supply, it's raising the cost of acquisition, both financially and in terms of time and effort. Brunello Cucinelli's limited production achieves a similar effect, albeit through a different mechanism.
So artificial scarcity alone isn't enough, it needs to be desirable scarcity. Got it. But what about businesses that thrive in competitive markets? Kyle mentioned Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Aren't monopolies supposed to be the holy grail of investing?
That's a crucial point. While investors often seek monopolies, Grieve argues that businesses can thrive in competitive markets if they possess hidden advantages, scale, brand dominance, distribution networks, that are difficult for competitors to replicate. The market often overlooks these subtle strengths. It's about identifying sustainable competitive advantages, regardless of industry structure.
Okay, so it's not always about finding the one company that controls everything. Let's talk about bubbles. Kyle called them exponential price increases detached from intrinsic value. Is there any upside to bubble, or are they purely destructive?
Grieve highlights a nuanced perspective. Bubbles simultaneously create lasting infrastructure and innovation. The railway system, the internet, both emerge from periods of speculative excess. The losses fall on less informed investors, but the resulting infrastructure benefits society as a whole. Recognizing this duality is crucial for a nuanced understanding of market cycles.
The dot-com bubble wasn't just Petscom imploding. There was actual good stuff that came out of it.
The commercialization of DWDM technology at Shenak Corp, as discussed in Top of the Morning, drastically reduced the cost per bit of data traffic, enabling the rise of Amazon and Google. Oversupply created demand. It's a classic economic principle. The postbus recovery was driven by that infrastructure.
Interesting. Okay, let's bring in Judd Kessler in market design. He talks about allocation processes not being purely luck-based, but governed by specific rules. How does that apply to investing specifically?
Kessler's work suggests that understanding these hidden economic rules can help secure scarce resources more effectively. Think about college admissions securing reservations at a top restaurant. These aren't random processes, they're governed by specific mechanisms. And those mechanisms can be strategically navigated. It's about recognizing the game and playing it to your advantage.
Playing the game? That sounds cynical, but I see the point. What about, say, IPOs? Is there a market design element there?
Definitely. IPO allocation is a prime example. It's not a purely merit-based system. It's heavily influenced by relationships, institutional investors, and the perceived story of the company. Understanding the rules of that allocation process, who gets priority, what signals are valued, is critical for participation.
A good story is more valuable than a good balance sheet.
It's a combination. But the plot mental model, as Grieve describes it, reveals that compelling narratives can be a powerful form of leverage. Yuval Noah Harari's Sapiens, written with no original research, gained immense traction because of its narrative power. Investment theses are inherently narratives, and their success depends on resonance, not necessarily factual novelty.
Right. The ability to sell the idea is often more important than the idea itself. What about government interventions? Kyle mentioned Canada's mobile coverage costs being 25 times higher than France. Is that a market design failure?
It's a clear case of an oligopoly distorting market competition. Bell Shaw and Rogers blocking Verizon's entry is a direct example of government interference protecting existing players. It's a failure to prioritize efficiency and equity, as Kessler would put it. The three E's, efficiency, ease, and equity, are vital considerations.
Sometimes the market needs to be disrupted, even if it's uncomfortable for existing players. Let's talk about shareholder base. Kyle said cultivating the right shareholders, long-term investors aligned with a company's values, is critical. How do you do that?
It's about framing narratives to attract ideal investors and repel those who aren't. Business management resembles skilled movie directing, as Grieve puts it. Companies strategically choose which KPIs to highlight, potentially attracting a specific type of shareholder. Luminant Topicus's use of free cash flow available to shareholders is a prime example, designed to emphasize their M&A-driven growth.
Free cash flow available to shareholders. That's a mouthful. What's so special about that metric?
It's relatively new, and it emphasizes cash flow over traditional metrics like revenue growth or EBITDA. Voiding EBITDA, as Luminant and Topicus deliberately do, signals that they aren't catering to investors who rely on it. It's a deliberate framing, signaling a fundamentally different operational philosophy.
What a company doesn't report can be as important as what it does. Okay, let's zoom out. What about geopolitical risks? South Korea's economic growth is lagging, and the shareholder meetings are a direct challenge to the Chaebol system. How do those factors intersect with investing principles?
South Korea's reforms are explicitly modeled after Japan's restructuring, but the Chaebol system is more deeply entrenched. Addressing the Korea discount through corporate governance improvements is seen as the most important catalyst for long-term foreign investment. The recent surge in shareholder proposals signals a shift in company willingness to engage, but it's still early days.
And then there's South Africa, facing tensions with the US and a potential geopolitical shock from the Iran war. How do you navigate that level of uncertainty?
The South African government's investment goals are complicated by these risks. Finance Minister Gorongwana acknowledges the uncertainty, stating that the impact will depend on the duration of the conflict. It's about assessing probabilities, diversifying risk, and recognizing that long-term investment requires weathering short-term volatility.
Okay, so we've talked about optimizing for change, understanding human behavior, navigating hidden market rules, and accounting for geopolitical risks. But ultimately, what does all this mean?
It means accepting that control is an illusion. As Git's work demonstrates, markets are a blend of price-driven and flow-driven activity, and genuine changes in underlying valuation are difficult to predict. It's about building resilience, diversifying risk, and recognizing that even the best models are imperfect. Frankly, predicting how these factors will play out, the Korean reforms, the South African economy, the global geopolitical landscape is impossible. That's why the quality of the management team, their alignment with long-term shareholders, and their willingness to admit mistakes are so crucial. Because if things go wrong, and they inevitably will, you want to be invested in a business that's capable of adapting.
The Pentagon is essentially importing its future warfighting capabilities from companies that might prioritize enterprise revenue over, say, avoiding a global incident.
The data tells a story. The core disagreement isn't if AI will be used, as the DoD acknowledges its necessity for managing information overload. 6,000-plus sorties against Iran alone demand it, but who sets the rules? That shift from in-house development to reliance on commercial entities like Anthropic fundamentally alters the military-industrial complex.
It's like outsourcing the rules of engagement to the people who also sell you the game.
An apt analogy. The traditional model of weapons technology originating from direct military demand has been flipped. This creates a disconnect between the values of AI developers and the military's needs, illustrated by Anthropic's concerns about offensive cyberattacks and the Pentagon's desire for broad lawful use access. It's not just about technical feasibility, it's about control and ethical boundaries.
And the definition of autonomous weapons seems elastic.
That's putting it mildly. Paul Scharr points to a lack of shared understanding, a semantic debate really. The spectrum ranges from assisted decision-making to fully independent targeting, but the Pentagon's current focus, as they describe it, is managing information for human analysts. Humans are still in the loop, ostensibly asking specific questions of models like Claude.
Ostensibly. Given the volume of data, isn't that loop going to become more of a rubber stamp?
That's the novel vulnerability. While the DoD aims for human oversight, the sheer scale of processing risks superficial review. The school strike incident, as the source material notes, exemplifies the challenge of maintaining data accuracy. Even with human intervention, the potential for rubber stamping AI outputs is significant.
So a human in the loop, but also a human potentially overwhelmed by the loop.
It's a telling detail. And the root cause of this reliance isn't a philosophical objection to AI within the military, but a practical one, a talent shortage and the immense investment required. Private enterprise dominates AI development due to broader commercial applications and greater capital availability.
Which means the Pentagon is reliant on companies that may be ideologically aligned with a specific worldview.
The perceived political alignment of Anthropic, described as libcoded, is influencing its adoption, even if contractual differences with competitors are minimal. It highlights how broader ideological factors are becoming intertwined with technological implementation. The company's success in coding, as David Sachs notes, was both ideologically and commercially sound, driving rapid revenue growth.
It's convenient.
It's a complex dynamic. But beyond that, the current AI safety concerns mirror the flash crashes seen in financial markets, highlighting the risk of emergent, unpredictable behavior in competitive environments. Unlike financial markets, though, there's no circuit breaker mechanism to halt escalation in warfare.
No pause button on mutually assured destruction.
Something to flag here, while AI could increase precision and reduce civilian casualties by flagging sensitive targets, the increasing automation of decision-making raises a moral hazard. Diminishing human engagement could lead to reduced accountability and potentially more suffering. A paradoxical outcome.
You're saying we might accidentally make war more humane by removing the humans who would object to inhumane acts?
That's the core of the risk. The long-term trend in warfare is toward greater distance between adversaries, and robotics represents the next stage. However, fully robotic wars are unrealistic because militaries will still need humans relatively close for command and control, especially against sophisticated adversaries capable of disrupting communications.
Stanislav Petrov seems relevant here.
There's a signal here. His prevention of a false nuclear launch serves as a cautionary tale about the importance of human judgment and intuition in automated systems. He distrusted a new system, understanding the stakes of conflict in a way that advanced AI cannot.
Because AI doesn't experience stakes. It just processes data.
So here's the picture, the inability of both humans and AI to fully articulate the reasoning behind their decisions. The gap between what we know and what we can articulate creates a unique risk in high-stakes scenarios. Reliance on instinctual understanding, which is difficult to codify, is being removed from the decision loop.
We're trusting increasingly complex black boxes with increasingly consequential decisions. And the most significant shift is that we bought those black boxes.
Correct. The integration of commercial AI products represents a historical shift, diverging from the traditional model. This flipped dynamic introduces new complexities, as commercial profitability may not align with military needs and raises questions about control and prioritization.
It feels fundamentally destabilizing. 3,000 draft posts leaking from Anthropic, causing a dip in Bitcoin and software stock values, isn't just a cybersecurity issue, it's a premonition of a larger vulnerability.
The Claude Mythos leak, described as a step change in performance, revealed unprecedented cybersecurity risks associated with highly capable AI models. It's a critical trade-off. Achieving significantly higher capabilities inherently introduces potentially catastrophic security vulnerabilities.
And we're just accepting that.
It appears so. The current integration of commercial AI products like Anthropic's Claude into military applications represents a historical shift, diverging from the traditional model of weapons technology originating from direct military demand.
Okay, so what didn't this conversation answer?
Honestly, the question of how to build genuine international consensus around AI governance in warfare remains entirely open. We've discussed the US-China competition, the internal disagreements within the US, and the vulnerabilities of reliance on commercial entities, but a shared global framework for ethical boundaries and safety protocols, particularly regarding the definition of an autonomous weapon system, is still completely absent. That's the critical gap.
Which feels less like a technical challenge and more like a geopolitical one. It's almost as if the escalating trade tensions are just a symptom of a deeper disagreement about what a future governed by AI looks like. You know what I noticed this week? Gas stations are starting to look like war zones again. It feels like we're stuck in a permanent cycle of energy shocks and geopolitical anxiety. Let's talk about global instability and the new trade landscape.
Consider this, the confluence of factors is truly destabilizing. We're seeing the long tail of Trump-era trade policies colliding with the immediate crisis in Iran, creating a situation where traditional trade routes and financial markets are under enormous pressure. Victoria Craig, Alan Beatty, and Katie Martin's reporting really highlights the interconnectedness of these risks.
Interconnectedness feels like a polite way of saying everything's broken. Trump's tariffs, a year of Liberation Day anniversaries, apparently didn't exactly reshape the global trading system, did they?
That's a fair assessment. Beatty points out the objectives were inconsistent. And while the administration is working around the Supreme Court ruling on IEPA tariffs, the fundamental impact has been limited. China continues to export to the U.S. through third countries, maintaining a substantial trade surplus. The U.S., representing 15 to 17% of global imports, can largely isolate itself, which makes the situation unique.
So tariffs are not working but also not completely irrelevant. That feels like a very Washington outcome.
We can trace that further. It's a strategic workaround. The U.S. economy's relative size allows for a degree of insulation, but the wider system is still absorbing the shock. More importantly, the Iran conflict is the acute pressure point. Oil prices are near conflict highs, contributing to a sell-off in bonds and stocks we haven't seen since 2022.
Katie Martin called that a nightmare scenario for investors. How long does this duration correlate to portfolio damage?
Directly, according to Martin, the longer the Iran conflict persists, the greater the damage. Rising energy prices are fueling inflation concerns, particularly in the $30 trillion U.S. government bond market, hindering price discovery and deal execution.
$30 trillion of bonds having trouble finding buyers. That sounds less like a market correction and more like a systemic fracture.
That's the concern. The instability in the treasury market raises the risk of financial blow up similar to the U.K. and Europe. Even hedge funds betting against volatility were caught off guard, demonstrating the fragility of the current system.
So the risk isn't just energy prices, it's the knock-on effects through the entire financial system.
Worth noting, that feeds directly into the growing concern about global stagflation. Central banks have limited capacity to control inflation driven by energy shocks, especially with the November midterm elections approaching.
Which, according to the reporting, Trump is actively trying to manipulate with these escalation-de-escalation tactics. It's like he's playing a very dangerous game of chicken with the global economy.
The reporting suggests that's a reasonable interpretation. Trump's communication strategy is a pattern of threats followed by apparent de-escalation, timed to influence oil prices and fuel price inflation. Markets have begun to anticipate this, though the diminishing returns are a worrying sign.
Diminishing returns on geopolitical brinkmanship. That's a new one. What about China in all of this? Are they just sitting back and watching the chaos unfold?
Not at all. They're continuing to export to the U.S. via third countries, circumventing tariffs. Beatty anticipates this pattern will persist due to their inherent competitiveness.
And if I'm reading this correctly, Fuse Energy is saying that even with renewables, gas prices ultimately set the wholesale electricity price due to inelastic demand.
Two things stand out. The attacks on Qatari LNG facilities are driving prices up, and hedging strategies are becoming more expensive and complex. Sean Murray anticipates a convergence of the Henry Hub and GCF gas price indices, reducing insulation for the U.S. market.
Renewables aren't a magic bullet against energy price shocks. They're subject to the same underlying vulnerabilities. And this grid congestion Murray talks about, shedding $70 billion in renewable energy, that's a network problem, not a technology problem.
He frames it as analogous to congestion issues in legacy Layer 1 blockchains, solvable with demand response mechanisms. He also predicts airdrops will be viewed as the most expensive marketing campaigns in history due to mercenary farming. A fascinating perspective.
Okay, so Trump's tariffs didn't work, the Iran conflict is destabilizing everything, China is playing the long game, and even renewable energy isn't immune to gas price volatility. Gold's price action is confusing though, right? fell 15%, then bounced off its 200-day moving average.
It is.
Greg Shearer noted a possible deleveraging flow reaching a grounding place, with its price action increasingly conditional on macro factors and investor demand. The situation is dynamic, with voyage times dictating regional impacts.
Dynamic is one word for it.
The key takeaway is that the conflict is unfolding as a stock depletion problem, impacts radiating outward from Asia based on shipping times. Demand destruction and price increases are the primary adjustment mechanisms.
Timing, not just volumes, is now the critical factor.
The implication runs deeper. That's all unfolding against a backdrop of increasing agency for Iran, who controls the Strait of Hormuz and is dictating market direction. The dollar isn't functioning as a safe haven currency, indicating a loss of investor confidence.
Which means Europe and Asia are bearing the brunt of the crisis, while the U.S. benefits from its energy security.
The pattern is clear in a nutshell. The global trade landscape is being reshaped not by deliberate policy changes, but by a series of cascading shocks and the inherent vulnerabilities of a deeply interconnected system.
We're looking at a sustained period of instability driven by energy price volatility, geopolitical risk, and a fundamental mismatch between policy intentions and real-world outcomes. That's not great.
A concise summary. The current crisis reveals the limitations of traditional trade strategies and the urgent need for more resilient, diversified, and technologically driven solutions, which, ironically, brings us to the challenges of liquidity in the shadow banking system and the rise of private credit.
Blankfein says there's kindling building up in the financial system. And apparently the trigger could be an oil price shock. It's like we're all waiting for a rogue wave, but the wave might be gasoline.
It's the conditional liquidity that's key, isn't it? He's pointing out that private credit only works until the moment when nobody's going to buy it. That fragility is masked by calling it semi-liquid, which feels generous. It's a stark echo of 2008, where illiquidity seized up everything.
Generous is one word. Let's talk accessibility. Leila Kunimoto mentioned retail investors are getting in. This feels like a bad idea.
It's a wider trend, the democratization of access through structures like interval funds. But it creates a paradox. Those retail checks are expensive to process for firms like KKR. They're used to CalPERS-sized investments, not a million small ones.
And then you've got these evergreen funds facing redemption pressure. 10 to 50% cap soon. That sounds uncomfortable.
It's a completely new complexity. They solve the traditional private equity J-curve problem, but constantly flowing capital introduces inefficiencies. The Florida Yellowstone example, prorated redemptions, illustrates that perfectly. It's almost like a slow-motion run on the bank.
A slow-motion run? I'm picturing people lining up at a Fidelity branch with slightly panicked expressions.
The structure of the market is fascinating, like a complex tapestry woven with clothes and PIVs, where risk is layered and often obscured. Funds like Cliffwater can keep assets off their balance sheets, inflating coverage ratios with leverage. But those low reported default rates are suspect.
Suspect. Payment in kind interest is a huge red flag, apparently. Borrowers paying with more loans instead of cash. That's not a good sign.
The data tells a story. It's a critical metric that analysts need to track. And public BDCs offer an arbitrage opportunity right now, trading at discounts to NAV. Buying at 80 cents and redeeming at $1 is attractive, but managers might shrink funds through buybacks.
The prisoner's dilemma for financial advisors. Redemptions are individually painless but collectively disastrous. Q2 inflow reports will be telling.
The capping of redemptions isn't necessarily negative. It's designed to prevent fire sales. But it does signal a slowdown and a shift in the market.
All right, let's make a prediction. By September 30th, we'll see at least 3 more high-profile evergreen funds announce redemption caps, specifically in the software loan space.
I agree. And I'll add to that, we'll see a minimum 25 basis point increase in spreads for new private credit loans by the same date, reflecting reduced investor liquidity and increased risk aversion. The funds need cash and the borrowers will pay for it.
That sounds plausible. It's a reminder that the true volatility in private markets isn't eliminated, it's just laundering through limited tender offers. Which neatly brings us to how information, or lack thereof, plays into all of this, particularly in the context of geopolitical maneuvering and AI-driven disinformation. We've got a classic tug-of-war unfolding, the US dismantling its own ability to talk to people abroad while simultaneously trying to influence them. Which side do you think wins that fight, Alex?
That's a remarkably succinct framing. I'd wager on the latter, unfortunately, at least in the short term. The administration's actions regarding the U.S. Agency for Global Media, reducing it to its statutory minimum, aren't about improving communication. They're about eliminating a perceived internal threat, despite lacking substantive evidence of bias. It's less a strategic pivot, more a war on the bureaucracy intersecting with hostility towards the press.
Rotten old husk, as one source put it. Still, $800 million a year feels significant.
It is significant, especially when contrasted with the cost of kinetic tools. Tom Kent points out an Apache attack helicopter runs $52 million. USAGM at $800 million total, Voice of America alone at $230 to $240 million is a force multiplier. It's cheaper to foster understanding than to blow things up, and historically, nations like the Soviet Union recognized that, investing more in jamming VOA than the US spent broadcasting it.
So Russia's celebrating this dismantling.
We can trace that further. It removes a key source of independent information, and we're already seeing the potential for a vacuum. China, for example, took over BBC frequencies in the Middle East after the BBC ceased operations there. This isn't just about talking points, it's about controlling information access.
And it's not like the US is leaving a pristine diplomatic landscape.
Consider this, look at Syria. The US is encouraging cooperation between the Syrian government and, oddly, against Hezbollah, while simultaneously failing to address the economic crisis that's undermining any political transition. The Trump administration's reluctance to lift sanctions fuels discontent, making the situation even more unstable. It's a strange posture to take while also trying to shape the hearts and minds of the population.
10 USAGM journalists are currently imprisoned in Vietnam, Iran, Belarus, and Russia.
That's the critical litmus test. If the administration allows them to rot, it signals a complete abandonment of international communication efforts. Securing their release would at least demonstrate a baseline commitment. It's a tangible measure of whether this is just bureaucratic streamlining or a genuine ideological shift.
Ideological shift seems likely given the framing. A decade-long effort to label USAGM as left-wing over minor incidents.
Correct. It's about firing thousands of leftist journalists, not efficiency. But even beyond that, USAGM offered a unique international communication function. Iranians learning about protests in other cities, for example, that's a benefit lost when you eliminate the channel.
Kent predicts a State Department or NSC reinvestment. Optimistic.
Grounded in the belief that strategic, military, and economic interests necessitate continued engagement. Even a pragmatic Pentagon would see the value of influencing local populations before or during interventions. But the window is closing. Looking ahead to April and May, we'll need to watch closely for any indication of resource allocation changes within the State Department. Specifically, whether funds are diverted from existing exchange programs or redirected towards bolstering independent media in strategically vital regions like Congo. The fate of those 10 journalists and the frequencies they use to reach audiences will be a clear indicator of the administration's true intentions.
Circling back on everything we've touched on today, Peloton's factory, Hermes pre-spent strategies, the $30 trillion bond market, even the $6,000+ sorties against Iran, it feels like we're all reacting to a fundamental destabilization. We spend a lot of time talking about models being wrong, right? But it's not just that the models are inaccurate, it's that the very environment they're built to predict is shifting so rapidly. It's not about finding the most efficient path anymore, it's about preparing for the path to change constantly.
So here's the picture. That shift is being driven, I think, by a confluence of forces. We've talked about it as a cascading series of shocks, but it's more systemic than that. It's a reordering of power, accelerated by technological disruption. The reliance on commercial AI, as we discussed, isn't just about efficiency, the Pentagon importing its future warfighting capabilities. It's about a fundamental change in the control structures of conflict. It's outsourcing the rules of engagement to the people who also sell you the game, and hoping they align with strategic interests.
Which leads to all sorts of unpredictable consequences. The shadow banking system, with its evergreen funds and conditional liquidity, feels like a direct parallel. We're seeing bubbles, exponential price increases detached from intrinsic value, and a rubber stamping of outputs because, frankly, nobody wants to look too closely. It's like tulip mania with spreadsheets, but with potentially global repercussions. And the US pulling back on information infrastructure abroad, it feels like creating a vacuum.
And that vacuum will be filled inevitably. The $800 million budget of the US Agency for Global Media, the 10 journalists imprisoned, the $230 to $240 million for Voice of America, these aren't just numbers. They represent a shrinking commitment to independent information sources and a strategic vulnerability. It's almost as if we're dismantling the tools for understanding the world while simultaneously trying to influence it. The tension between qualitative and quantitative data feels acute here. We're trying to navigate a world with increasingly sophisticated tools, but diminishing our ability to interpret the signals.
So what does this mean going forward? We predicted redemption caps for evergreen funds by September, a 25 basis point spread increase in private credit, but beyond those data points, I think we're looking at a period of heightened volatility and systemic risk. Watch the State Department's resource allocation closely. That will be a clear signal of intent regarding international communication.
And keep a close eye on the definition of autonomous weapons. The ambiguity is dangerous. The entire situation feels fragile. Like a rogue wave, but the wave might be gasoline. A slow motion run on the bank, but instead of dollars, it's trust in the systems themselves. It's a rotten old husk, as one source put it, but we're still trying to extract value from it.
It's a strange position to be in.
It is.
But acknowledging the complexity, the uncertainty, is the first step.
Stepping back, thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow to unpack another layer of this.